You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 277, talking to strangers on the London Chib. Not a good idea. The football managerial merry-go-round. And how to react when you don't win an award. Yeah, like that time I had to hand over my crown to Miss Philippines. Oh, all that and more coming up after St. Etienne and Mr. Donut. Yeah.
Checked in at the airport half an hour late. Jackie caused a scene when we reached the gate. Sorry, Mr. Pilot, but you'll have to wait. 'Cause Paul's still in the duty free. When I'm far from home, you call me on the phone. Tell me stupid name that makes me smile and in a while it's ooh, another coffee, yeah. Ooh, can you sense it in the air? Feels so good, like someone really cares.
second week in a row you'll be hearing me before Terence, which, you know, I might think is how it should be. That is the excellent St. Etienne and the somewhat intriguingly named Mr. Donut, taken from their 1998, I think, LP, Good Humour, which is probably, fact fans, my favourite St. Etienne LP. But anyway, I've been Juliet, so I'm now going to throw to my co-host in a very professional manner.
Isn't Mr. Donut is a chain, isn't it? A fast food, obviously, donut places in America.
Well, you're better travelled than me. Yeah. It's about someone getting on a plane and flying away, isn't it? So
it is. Yeah.
This is why you do the intros and not me, presumably. But anyway, let's carry on.
Well, welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It is, in fact, episode 277. I am Terence Stackham, and there's no getting away from it. She's Juliet Harris.
Yeah, as much as one might want to. Hello.
Jules, there's been some misplaced ideas in our time. One thinks of the TV executive who commissioned Mrs. Brown's Boys, or of Margaret Beckett, whose nomination vote for Jeremy Corbyn took him one over the required 35 votes in the 2015
election. Yeah. To be fair, she has been loudly repentant about being a quote-unquote moron about that. So, yes. And also, Mrs. Brown's Boys, how can 8, 9, 10 million people in including Michael Gove, be wrong.
Oh, they can. Oh, they can. perhaps joining them in the list of daft schemes is Jonathan Dunn, because what Londoners need is an American encouraging us all to talk to each other on tube trains, the subway for American listeners. Mr. Dunn has spent the week handing out badges, and if I've understood this correctly, Jules, they indicate to your fellow tube travellers that the wearer would enjoy some chit-chat.
You see, now I am markedly more pro-chat than you.
Lord.
I mean, you know, enormously so. Mm. We will talk about how anti-chat you are a bit later, I suspect. But I am one of those quite cheery people who often naturally falls into conversation with people.
No.
I don't need a badge in order to work out if someone wants to chat or not. I've got something called social skills, which don't really tend to come bound in plastic with a pin on the back. They're a bit more nebulous than that. Having said that, interestingly, I'm quite a chatty person. Generally, often fall into chat with people at gigs, in shops, that sort of thing. And you know, it's never deep and meaningful, but you can have a little bit of a, I don't want to say banter because that word is hateful, but you know, badinage, I don't know. But but having said that, the one place where I feel completely oppressed that I don't want any kind of chat at all is the tube. I can never. It's bizarre. I find it extremely dislocating that you can be on the tube in rush hour and there can be hundreds of you walking through a corridor and all you can hear is silence.
Mm.
No one is talking. Bizarrely, people don't tend to get the tube together. You don't tend to get people talking to each other very much. Everyone sits on the tube, and I would probably no sooner start a conversation on the tube than I would do fly through the air, because there is something about tube vibes that just tends to crush everybody before them, and I don't know why that is. Maybe I should go all Dad's Army on this. Americans coming over here, telling us how to chat on our tubes. I'm not having this.
Well, of course, on many of the older lines and trains, they rattle away so loudly.
Of course,
you have to raise your voice to be heard at all. And so the idea of standing, I don't know, hemmed in against some geezer in a pungent tracksuit and engaging him in conversation about the UKIP election, it just gives me the heebie-jeebies.
It does.
But I'm pretty much opposed to small talk in all its forms, as you said.
And I was going to say, you are consistent on this. Just before we hear about how anti-small talk you are, I'm reading this BBC article that you sent to me in preparation for this. Beautifully summed up by the opening kind of line they have in bold, saying, the man behind the badges encouraging people to chat on the tube says that he thought it would be way more fun than it was. Doesn't that tell a story? There's also a picture of this chap who is wearing I'm going to have to create a picture on the radio. Mm. Where wears a wax jacket, green wax type jacket with a moleskin brown rust collar and a green tweed flat cap. I think this is someone who is, if he is American, is trying desperately to understand the idea of being English, whilst at the same time completely fundamentally misunderstanding what it is to be English, i.e. being rather reserved, I think.
Yes, he does seem rather misguided. No, I will give you a recent example of why I feel this way. I suppose it must be every 6 weeks, I give my mother a lift to her hairdresser's. Being a dutiful young man, you know.
Well, you are a very nice young man.
Exactly. And for the hour or so that she's there, it's not really worth me going home or too far away. So just about the only place available to wait is a Wetherspoons pub a few doors along.
No. My heart's beating faster for you already, because I know how much you hate these situations, and yet here you are.
It's very popular, this place, and I'm lucky if I find a free table. And a couple of weeks ago, I took her there, and I took her into the hairdresser, went to the Wetherspoons, sat down with my Diet Pepsi, and...
Wow, life's
I live on the edge. I live right on the edge, because I also had my Daily Telegraph that I spread out.
Wow, man spreading with a Diet Coke.
And a Daily Telegraph. Absolutely. Yeah. Really trying hard not to make eye contact with anyone. But
sorry, it's not funny.
then this woman, you see, of mature years, I suppose, she came right over, and as there weren't any free tables, she asked if she could share my table for what she said would be a few minutes. She actually said, I won't disturb you.
And well, you see, you should have seen through that from the off, frankly.
It was a lie, Jules. She was just telling a lie because you see, the thing was, she saw I was reading the sports section and she started to make
small talk. I'm gripping my desk and my knuckles have gone that kind of yellowy white on your behalf.
It's the Weatherspoons equivalent of tube chat. Yes, yeah, so she said, oh, any good games on tonight? So I said, well, yes, there's a couple of Champions League games on, I believe. And I sort of rustled the paper impatiently.
Pointedly, yeah.
She didn't cotton on. And she warmed to her theme.
So
she said, oh, who do you support then? So I said, well, Chelsea. And this led her on to a speech of a length that would have impressed Shakespeare, I suppose. But but the amazing thing was, despite the length of the speech, it only contained like a handful of words. It was just that she kept reusing the same words. They're just slight variations. And this is what she said. So I'll give the brief version. You need to imagine her saying the same thing for maybe 5 minutes. It may have been felt like an hour, but it was probably 5 minutes. She said, oh! So this is her speaking now. Oh, Chelsea. And I mean, you're going to think this is a parody, but this is actually the way she spoke. Chelsea, if you ask me what team I support, which I wasn't going to do, by the way, but if you ask me what team I support, I'd have to say to you, Arsenal and Chelsea. Not one or the other, but both. So, you see, if you'd have said to me, if you sat down, and we'd have sat down together, and you'd have said, what team I support, I'd surprise you, and I'd say Arsenal and Chelsea. Two teams, Arsenal and Chelsea. Imagine, if I'd sat down here now, and you turned to me, and you said, now, what team do you support? I couldn't say one team. I'd have to say Arsenal and Chelsea. Two teams, that's me. Two teams, Arsenal and Chelsea. Just think now, if you'd asked me, you'd have sitting there with your paper, right, and you might have said to me, what team do you support? I'd have to say two teams. And that went on for like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I don't know.
During that, I sat and wistfully watched all of our listeners deciding that they had better things to do and shutting their podcast windows and walking away. And to be honest, I'm surprised you didn't decide you had better things to do and got up and walked away. But unfortunately, you are still polite, even if you hate small talk.
That's probably the problem, isn't it? It's a prime example of why I avoid small talk at all costs and why Mr.
Dunn's...
public
spaces generally,
absolutely. So any interaction with anybody, really, to be honest. Mr. Dunn's concept of tube chat, it sends the severest shiver through my very soul.
And I have to say, you know, a hashtag pray for Terence after that particular encounter.
I'll be going back there in a couple of weeks. It's really worrying me.
I'd advise some dark glasses, I think, and some sort of thing. And actually, that's an interesting point that people, when people do engage in small talk, and I talked earlier about judging if people are up for conversation or not, that this lady here, as friendly as she was trying to be, seemed to lack the social skills to realise that, you know, perhaps you didn't want to hear the same thing over and over again for 5 minutes. Going back to this chat in this article that we were talking about, when he talked about handing out these badges to people and cards, it says, Jonathan says he first came up with the idea a couple of months ago when an event at work did not go as he had planned. He said, I'm on the social committee and we tried to do a staff Olympics. You got time off of work and no one was interested, he explained. No one showed up. The people that did show up didn't participate and I just thought it would be nice to get past the barriers. People are very uncomfortable, and I don't know if it's just a London thing with very basic social interactions. I see colleagues that I've worked with for years on the street, and you ignore each other. I suspect that the ignoring of this poor chap might be more one-sided than he thinks. He obviously hasn't quite got the hint yet that if no one turns up to your staff Olympics at work, maybe people, which sounds like the most hideous idea anyway. As someone that had to participate in Silly Sock Friday yesterday to raise money for charity, I understand why that's not necessarily, you know, for everyone. So yeah, this chap, much like your lady, they are bound together. People that encourage us to have conversations, ironically, people that want people to talk more and exhibit social skills in public sometimes lack the social skills and nuance themselves to realise that not everybody is like them.
Maybe I should link up Jonathan Dunn with my Wetherspoons woman and they could bring joy into each other's lives.
Well, to be fair, they probably still, if you introduced them yesterday, they'd probably still be talking now, wouldn't they? So that would be nice.
We're back looking at the job with the shortest lifespan other than UKIP leaders. That's football management, right after PM Dawn. Whatever it is I do, I try to think about you. I have a love for you, but nothing has greater. Whatever it is I do, I'm always thinking of you. I hope you look at me, be patient. I stand corrected. How well you read, you speak the truth, you speak to me, you feel the love I have yet to find. I know it's there, I know it's there, but I let the sandcastles kill my mind. Pathetic me, I long to be you. I think I'm close, but I stand so far. The turbulent one sheds a turbulent tear. I miss the love only cause they stop. Oil and water, lust and sympathy are life and death, my way through the sun. Where originates all the pain that leaves my memory a traumatic sponge and sinks to you. Shadows the moon that sings to you. Number 11 in the UK, number 6 on the Billboard Hot 100 in 1992. One of my favourite bands, and from one of my favourite albums, the Bliss album. That's PM Dawn and Looking Through Patient Eyes. Jules, The reason we're looking at managerial shuffles in football has absolutely definitely not got anything to do with me wanting to point out that
oh,
for
no,
once
I knew this was coming.
I've got a prediction correct. The sacking of Francesco Guidolin from Swansea this week gives me an early lead in our pre-season prediction contest, as I did pick the unfortunate Mr. Guidolin as my selection for first Premiership management casualty.
In your face, Twitter fans of ours who've been gleefully going on for the last year about how rubbish our predictions are. We have at least got one fig leaf.
I fear it'll be the only one, but we'll see.
It'll probably be short-lived, I suspect, but anyway.
But once again, the quirkiness of football ownership is on full display here. Guidolin was only appointed by Swansea last January, and then at the end of last season, in May of this year, the owner offered him a new two-year contract, only to fire him after seven games in the new season, meaning that they've had, Swansea have had four managers in 4 years now. But I think you know of a club that actually really knows the meaning of short-termism.
Yes, absolutely. Your friends and mine, Leeds United, former giants of the football world, you know, dirty, dirty Leeds, as some of us still know them. But perhaps the most, they are known in the latter day for getting through managers like hot dinners. Their perhaps most famous brief manager was, of course, the ill-fated spell of Brian Clough there in the 70s.
That was only a few days as well. It was like
42,
a month,
I think. And it became famously the subject of a book, but an excellent book by David Peace called The Damned United, which was then made into a terrific film starring Martin Sheen and Timothy Spall. The film is somewhat lighter than the book, which talks a lot about, plays a lot on Brian Clough's kind of drinking problems and that sort of thing, but they're both excellent, and my favourites, the fact that it was not going to go on, it'd be interesting to see if any of these managers that have been flung away got off to such a bad start as Brian Clough, who turned up at Leeds after they had won all sorts of trophies and honours, but were famous obviously for being, you know, being dirty Leeds, as I said earlier, and his opening team talk to the team was to announce that they should all throw all of their medals away because they had been won by cheating.
It
did not go well, Brian Clough's time there, but Leeds have continued in their proud tradition of having managers for 30 seconds and then booting them out. Leeds have had, since 2002, they have had 21 managers.
Oh, my God. My goodness.
Since 2013, but to be fair, 10 of those have been in the last 3 years.
That is astonishing.
Since 2013. They've been through, well, to be fair, Leeds have been through several owners as well and chair people, and we will all remember when they got Ken Bates to shore the ship up. As a Chelsea fan, I suspect you had some scepticism as to whether or not that was ever going to work. And of course now they have. I was trying to explain Leeds to someone the other day who just could not understand how wild things have got at Leeds at the moment. They're not helped by their current owner, who is almost their current sort of chairman owner person is almost Mohamed Fayed.
Yes, he is, isn't he? Yeah.
And it's kind of not failing or not passing the fit and proper persons test. Massimo Cellino is his name. Been convicted in the Italian court of tax legislation. He's been various sort of issues regarding tax legislation. He's appealed various things. There's been problems at Leeds where Lucy Ward, who's a former England international, and her husband were involved in coaching. Her husband was a manager there, I think, for a bit, and they were involved in. She was involved in coaching, and they got rid of her when they sacked the manager, and she successfully sued them for unfair dismissal. So they're Leeds is not a happy camp. It's not a stable camp. And surely all the time that you're flinging managers out, you know, it's no surprise at all that Leeds are not doing massively well at the moment. They're in the Championship, but that seems to be by accident rather than by design, I think. They finished 13th last season, so they are, I mean, they're still playing at Elland Road. They've got such a proud history, and yet, you know, because they're being run by a someone who perhaps could be running them better and taking their frustrations out on the managers. The many the cast of thousands that are the previous Leeds United managers over the last 15 years. How are you ever going to build stability if you're always swinging people out? The reverse example is Sir Alex Ferguson at Manchester United, of course.
Yes, of course. I mean, it's an absolutely prime example. I mean, it's an increasingly volatile mix, I think. Capricious owners who simply cannot understand that if you want... Mm-hmm. Well, if you... It's simple mathematics. If you have 20 teams in a league, then 19 of that 20 are destined not to win that league. You know, and of course, now that's seen as unforgivable, catastrophic failure, which can only be turned around by appointing yet another hopeful fellow to the manager's role. But what are the curious... I thought this is very interesting to me. One of the curious sideshows to the change at Swansea was a sort of clamour from the media in particular, and ex-players, colleagues of this fellow, that this was a job made for Ryan Giggs. And indeed, it's been reported that he was interviewed with the notion that Nicky Butt would be his assistant. But Swansea seemed to have let it be known that he performed terribly at the interview, and so the owners changed their mind and went for the more experienced and certainly articulate American Bob Bradley. I think we keep hearing questions raised about why more British coaches aren't given a chance at the top level, and I wonder if the Giggs Swansea interview feedback is symptomatic of a wider problem. These young British coaches, they may have acquired the badges, the football qualifications that they need, but are they articulate enough to handle the media, and do they possess, I think this is key, the finesse and language skills to get the best out of footballers earning anything, I don't know, up to 20 million quid a year? It's obviously some kind of rhetorical question. I think it highlights the issue that for years, especially in football, but not exclusive to it, by the way, it's seen as somehow uncool to be intelligent and to be able to form views on topics other than what bonuses are on offer this season and shall I buy a luxury villa in Dubai. We might call it the Robbie Savage syndrome, and maybe Giggs is the latest example.
Well, I don't know, because part of the problem with Giggs is, I think I've talked about this in the podcast before, my entire family, my mum and dad and me, were all enormous Ryan Giggs fans.
As a player, Jules.
Yeah, absolutely. We were big fans of him as a player, but we also rather liked him. But we went beyond that, Terence. We were Ryan Giggs fans as well. When he was interviewed, we liked him. We thought he was good. We thought he was. He seemed like a very, he didn't seem the most articulate person ever. But we thought he seemed very decent and that he seemed very committed. And we just all rather liked him. And then, of course, the super injunction nonsense kicked off, and we were all utterly heartbroken at the thought that Ryan Giggs was not the good egg that we all thought he was. I'm interested in people like him, and also Paul Scholes, I think, is a good example here. Alex Ferguson said about Paul Scholes once that Paul Scholes was a man of very few words, but what words he said were usually extremely insightful and worth listening to. And actually, I find Paul Scholes, who's moving into punditry now, to be very interesting and articulate and insightful. So maybe, going back to our small talk thing earlier, maybe one doesn't have to be ebullient in order to have value. I don't know. Maybe you don't want... kind of wacky people like Robbie Savage managing your football team. Maybe you do want the slightly more brooding people. And also a job, it's weird, job interviews are strange anyway. And particularly in the world of football, where it's sitting in a room with people with suits and then talking about things seems to be so entirely different to what you would actually be doing as a football manager and a coach and all that kind of stuff. I can picture Ryan Giggs in a tracksuit with RG on it, pointing at cones on a training ground. I can see him doing that. I can't see Ryan Giggs in a suit in a boardroom somewhere telling people where he thinks he'll be in 5 years' time. That's not the same thing. So actually, I know that you have to talk to people beforehand, but I have some sympathy with Ryan Giggs here. Firstly, why is it any of my business that he didn't do very well at a job interview? For God's sake, if the country knew how I did at some of my job interviews, I'd never leave the house. I have sympathy with Ryan Giggs here. And also, again, it's symptomatic as to, badly run clubs it doesn't, you know, it doesn't indicate very well that, you know, they're Swansea talking about, you know, a slagging off people that didn't get the job in public. That doesn't strike me as a job that one would particularly want, really, if that's what the employer is like.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it was very peculiar that they let that information slip out. I'm imagining it was because of the clamour of, you know, the ex-pros like Shearer and others who were saying, oh, you know, what's wrong with Ryan Giggs? And I think they probably said, well, you know, we did give him a chance, but... the thing is, though, about, oh, you know, you can't pitch people in a suit in a boardroom. But I think these days, you have to be able to multi-skill like that. For example, I can picture Pep Guardiola or Jurgen Klopp reporting back to their respective chairman or owners during the week and saying, well, this is what happened at the weekend. Maybe not in a suit, but able in maybe five or six languages, certainly in Guardiola's wardrobe. He's got five or six languages. Mourinho, I think, speaks five or six languages. And able to converse articulately about what's going on with the team. Now, if you are a capricious owner and you've got some monosyllabic maybe a very superstar of a footballer, but who can barely put one word in front of the other in the boardroom, you are perhaps going to think to yourself, is he going to be able to motivate people like Zlatan or Eden Hazard or, you know, other, as I say, these £20 million a year people? And I suspect that the answer is, you would think, well, no, I don't think they can, because if he can't come into this boardroom and explain to me in words of more than my lady at Wetherspoons, then, you know...
Has anyone tipped her for the job? That's what I'm
I may find out in a couple of weeks. She'll probably be telling me all that's wrong with Arsenal and Chelsea.
Absolutely, yes, indeed.
How to prepare yourself if you're up for an award. That's next, right after Joni Mitchell.
Help me, I think I'm falling in love again. When I get that crazy feeling, I know I'm in trouble again. I'm in trouble, cause you're a rambler and a gambler. Talking ladies, man, and you love your loving. Not like you love your
from her glorious, triumphant album, Caught and Spark, Joni Mitchell, track two, Help Me. I think I'm four.
I always love a bit of Joni. It's always nice to have her around the place.
She was at her most sophisticated at that time. She had really developed her vocal style, and of course the record company was happy to put more money into the production, and Caught and Spark is one of the best albums of all time. Jules,
although can I also put the case for The Hissing of Summer Lawns, which I've always been very fond of as well. I'm a big fan of that.
And increasingly available, it was a bootleg for a while, but now increasingly available on what I believe you call the internet.
Is the, yes, the Wonder Web, as my mum used to call it, yes.
Is the demo of The Hissing of Summer Lawns. I think it's called The Seeding of Summer Lawns. And listening to the demo versions of track, sometimes you listen to, you know, additional extras of a demo version, you think,
They're underwhelming, aren't they? Yeah,
but this is just fantastic. It's really just Joni with an acoustic guitar or a piano, and it's just wonderful hearing those track paired down.
Yes, thank you for that. I had no idea that existed. So
we talked about the Mercury Prize recently, and I said I'm increasingly less likely to go to award ceremonies because of the whooping, shouting and screeching that goes on, generated by PR people and the like. But you've got some guidance for us. It seems I've been looking at this whole concept the wrong way.
Absolutely, yes. Well, when we were talking about it last week, I was reminded of what I don't know what it is about some newspaper articles that just kind of stay with you, even if they are about something inconsequential. And Charlotte Higgins is she's a writer for The Guardian. She's been writing for them for some years, I think, doing sort of various. She's the chief culture writer now, and she's also on the editorial board. So she's got, and she's also written a book recently about the BBC, which they've published extracts on, which looks very good actually. So she's you know, a name, and she's got a profile. She wrote a book about Roman Britain about 4 or 5 years ago called Under Another Sky. It was shortlisted for something called the Samuel Johnson Prize, which is the biggest British non-fiction award. So it's a big deal, and she won't ask about it in The Guardian. I've looked it up. It was November 2013. And I'll read you the opening couple of the opening paragraph. She says, "In the fortnight or so running up to the presentation of the Samuel Johnson Prize, the biggest British non-fiction award, a certain game was played in my household. It involved my boyfriend or I uttering the words Charles Moore at deliberately unexpected moments during washing up, say, or toothbrushing. The other would then have to break immediately into a smile and burst into enthusiastic applause. The Charles Moore game was about limbering up our good losers' faces." And she says she was shortlisted. She said the former editor of The Telegraph, Charles Moore, was shortlisted for the first volume of his biography of Margaret Thatcher. And she says, "I do not have anything against the impeccably well-mannered Moore. I do, however, reserve the right to have something against his subjects." She says, "I became pretty good at the Charles Moore game, although when I tried it out on the novelist Philip Hensher, who's also won and lost various prizes, he thought my delighted grin and vigorously enthusiastic head movements came out as a touch hysterical." So she's talking about, and it's actually a very interesting article about how, you know, how one prepares oneself for defeat. And I know this is a spoiler alert, but the article is titled "Charlotte Higgins on what it's like not to win the Samuel Johnson Prize." And neither her nor Charles Moore win it in the end. Someone else does. But she's also quite interested, also quite entertaining, that she said that she'd also, in a kind of a weird twist of fate, was then told that she had to cover it as the Guardian chief arts writer. So she was there as a reporter as well as a nominee, which is even more bizarre. So it's very... I was very entertained listening to the idea that people don't necessarily talk about this. People don't necessarily think about you know, the idea that, you know, when you go for an award or something, you're preparing yourself not to win. In the end, the winner was Lucy Hughes Hallett, and so it wasn't the Charles Moore game turned out to be erroneous, really. But I was very entertained with this idea that, you know, that we're all, in a way, we're all putting a face on through life, and I admire the honesty of someone that admits that they're having to build themselves up to be gracious, that it doesn't necessarily come naturally.
It's awful, those, when it's high profile awards like the Oscars, the Emmys or the BAFTAs, whatever, and they zoom in on all four or five nominees as that person's opening the envelope, and then I find I'm more transfixed by looking at, as you quite rightly say, the people that lose when they say, and the winner is Dame, Dame Judi Dench. And then you look at all the people that didn't win.
And yes, everyone else. They do the thing on the Oscars where they show them as a sort of a square of four,
that's
don't
it.
They?
Yes.
So you get to see the reaction shot, which I think is monstrously unpleasant. But anyway.
I do carry a degree of baggage when it comes to awards in television and film.
Oh, yes. Do tell us.
Well, I don't think I'm alone in this, but for some reason, we absolutely venerate the director of a TV show, and particularly a movie. In fact, you know, films are often referred to, in fact, usually referred to as, I don't know, Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver or Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland. And the poor writer and other people with significant roles, they're kind of relegated to also-rans or not mentioned at all.
Mm.
I don't blame the directors for this. It just seems to be the way film in particular has evolved. Well, I worked on a film back in 2007, and my agent called me and said, "That's really good news. That movie that you've been working on, it's up for an award. It's the British Independent Film Awards, and the ceremony's at the Roundhouse, and it'll be red carpet and everything." And I even, at the time, I even did a couple of interviews about the movie and its success.
Yeah.
And so I waited for the embossed invitation to arrive. Did it ever arrive? No, it didn't.
And oh, no.
There goes the director up to collect the award, and it's still, no doubt, sitting on a sideboard in his mother's house to this day. The
and
British,
nobody else got one.
No. But am I bitter, Jules? Well,
you're doing your best not to be is probably the best assessment I can give of that.
No, I don't mind at all. But it does indicate that, you know, this awards thing is utterly bizarre. And it is another reason. It's not Sour Grapes. Why I just don't go to them anymore, because it's just absurd. The whole thing's absurd.
It's putting yourself through this kind of... It's putting yourself through things. And actually, this article is very interesting. Mm. She says, here's the funny thing. One does feel like a loser after all of this. She said, after Deborah Raw put it in The Guardian, after her husband Will Self missed out on the Man Booker, one starts out being pleased to be not longlisted and ends up feeling anything other than winning is failure. And Charlotte Hawkins concludes by saying, I've learned that the appropriate sentiment on meeting a runner-up, and I feel sure the same goes for football leagues, quiz teams, flower-arranging competitions and whatnot, is to congratulate them for their achievement rather than offering commiserations. She says the former can be acknowledged with a delighted thank you, and the latter requires an explanation. After all, I never expected to win, and I'm so pleased that of all people Lucy did, etc., etc., which is true, but as she puts it, fatiguing to express. And she says, she concludes and says, because the Charles Moore game takes you only so far, I'm afraid the last text message I sent to my boyfriend the day after the prize read, I am so fed up with being the effing gracious loser, block capitals, all day. So yes, I obviously I've never been nominated for an award. Obviously I've always interestingly, actually my only experience of awards is failing to be even nominated. The Sony Awards, the radio awards, have a category which has kind of public input into it, called the Golden Headphones Award, where you could nominate someone for it and then they shortlisted. So I engaged on a spirited social media campaign on Facebook and Twitter to ask people to nominate me for it, hosting Indie Wonderland. It was when I was working for a station called ARFM, and to be fair, they publicised it as well, because luckily no one else on the station had heard about it, so no one else wanted to be nominated. So everyone was, you know, we all pulled together and you know, got people to vote for me and put the link up all the time. My mum got all her friends to do it, and you know, we were all working very hard, and I didn't get anywhere near the nominations list, and the winner were two chaps that hosted an evening show on Radio 1. So it just goes to show that, you know, these award things, yes, they are lovely fairy tale things for the people that win them, but they're often aimed at a certain level, aren't they? They weren't named at me and my friend Steve's spare bedroom radio station. They were named by people that already had huge profiles on Radio 1. So yes, that's my streak, and I will openly be bitter about that. That's, you know, I'm not the charade of pretending I'm not. I definitely am.
I seem to recall that I voted for you in those awards.
Yes, you did. You were very enthusiastic about it. And again, very grateful to everybody that took the time to help me with that. I'm sorry that we all, in fact, wasted our time, but never mind.
Nonetheless, you'll be, I imagine, presenting potentially award-winning radio this week.
as yet non-award-winning radio. But yes, after a complete massive iTunes fail this week, which I'm still cross about, corrupted libraries and whatnot, I am meant to be, hopefully will be, on the radio this evening doing the Saturday social. Q&R this week. Weirdly, not enough Q to fill a whole hour. So Q&R of Northern Soul, Motown, Mod, etc. 6 till 7pm, barricaderadio.com. Next week, on the Wednesday, whatever the Wednesday is next week, I'll be doing my usual Indie Wonderland show on Barricade Radio, which is tunes and chat and all sorts of things like that. And I'm a poet and I'm simply unaware of this. 8 until 10pm, barricaderadio.com, Indie Wonderland.
Wednesday the 12th, in fact.
Yes.
He says, looking at his Chelsea football desk calendar.
I knew that, you know, your boys in blue would not let us down.
Oscar featured as the October pin-up, I should let you know. Huge thanks to executive producer Rona. Thanks to you for listening. And this is a lovely track to play us out, Jules.
Yeah, I'm really rather fond of this. It's a curious little thing, but I didn't know much about this band until I'd heard this. This is a band called Unknown Mortal Orchestra, and I like this has got high levels of whist on this track, and I like a bit of whist. So this track is called obviously doesn't apply to me or Terence at all. So good at being in trouble.
It's the story. You have been listening to a DACM Media production.